Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a resident, and this is episode 146 of the Divine Intervention podcast. And in this podcast, I'll be talking about renal pharmacology. I'm going to break it up in parts because renal pharm is just one of those things you really want to understand. I was really shocked. I think it was yesterday or thereabouts. I was like, oh, wait. I feel like I've covered all pharmacology, at least that's tested commonly on the USMLE Step 1 exam. But I noticed that I was like, wait, renal. I don't seem to remember having made any renal podcasts. And I really did look through the entire website and didn't see anything like that. And I was perplexed. So I think it makes sense to make a renal podcast, obviously, for the purposes of the USMLE Step 1 exam. So let's jump right into it. And again, I will talk about like renal pharmacology, but again, I'm going to talk about it from the context of how the material will likely be tested on exams. So let's go ahead and begin, right? So obviously, right, renal pharmacology is something that you probably would never be able to understand if you don't have a good understanding of the renin-angiotensin aldosterone system, right? So remember that renin, right, ultimately comes from the juxtaglomerular cells, which are a subset of cells that constitute the afferent arteriole. And this renin converts angiotensinogen, right, which actually does come from the liver, to angiotensin 1. And then that angiotensin 1 is converted to angiotensin 2 by angiotensin converting enzyme, which you find in the endothelial cells of the lung, right, like the lung capillaries, right? And the thing is, angiotensin 2, it's super high yield to know all its different functions for the exam, right? So angiotensin 2, for example, it goes to the supraoptic nucleus of the hypothalamus, right, so that you can release ADH. Remember, don't confuse the supraoptic nucleus of the hypothalamus releasing ADH to the paraventricular nucleus of the hypothalamus releasing oxytocin. Don't confuse those two things. And you may say, Divine, do I need to know these nuclei of the hypothalamus for step one? What do you think? You better know them, right? These are things that show up all the time on the exam. And then another function of angiotensin 2, right? It actually increases a systemic vascular resistance, right? So the thing is, it actually raises blood pressure, right? It's a very powerful vasoconstrictor. It does this by binding to the angiotensin 2 type 1 receptor, okay? Again, there are certain receptors, like drug receptors, that your friends at the NBME really want you to know, like in excruciating detail. They like you to know the receptor that is blocked by the ADP receptor blockers in the world of hematology, right? So like your clopidogrel, your prasugrel, your ticagrelor, right? Those block the ADP receptor. But again, your friends at the NBME realize that every human being has memorized the word ADP receptor. So the name they go after on exams these days is the P2Y12 receptor. That's something you certainly want to commit to memory. Another classic one is the leukotriene receptor, right? So if you remember, right, like lipoxygenase converts arachidonic acid to leukotrienes, right? And the thing is, I mean, you can inhibit lipoxygenase to shut down the leukotriene pathway with a drug like Xyluton, or you can actually block the leukotriene receptor by giving drugs like Montelukast and Zafirlukast, right? So that receptor is known as, again, leukotriene receptor, right? But the thing is, your friends at the NBME prefer that you learn it as the CYSLT1 receptor. So CYSLT1 receptor, okay? So I would encourage you, do not just remember, oh, angiotensin 2 receptor. No, remember that the angiotensin 2 receptor is the angiotensin 2 type 1 receptor, okay? That is the receptor that is activated by angiotensin 2 to cause an increase in vascular resistance, right? So causes vasoconstriction. And then another thing that angiotensin 2 does is it actually goes to the zona glomerulosa of the adrenal cortex, right? And in so doing that, it stimulates the release of aldosterone, right? Remember, the adrenal cortex has like the zona glomerulosa that secretes aldosterone, the zona fasciculata that secretes glucocorticoids like cortisol, and then the zona reticularis that releases sex steroids, primarily DHEAS. Okay, so again, those are high yield things to know. And remember that the zona fasciculata and zona reticularis are under the control of ACTH, okay, adrenal corticotropic hormone. But the zona glomerulosa is actually not under the control of ACTH for the most part. It's more under the control of the renin-angiotensin aldosterone system. So angiotensin 2, right, goes to the zona glomerulosa of the adrenal cortex Okay, that stimulates the release of aldosterone. And the thing is, aldosterone has a myriad of functions, right? Some very high yield functions you want to know for exams, right? So the first thing is, and I will talk about these different transporters because, again, review is always helpful. I'll talk about them probably like in the next podcast, although I will make a lot of mention of them in this podcast. But the thing is, aldosterone, if you go to the level of the distal convoluted tubule, it increases the activity of the sodium chloride symporter that you find on the urine side, okay? So that helps with the with increasing like sodium and chloride reabsorption. So water follows alongside. Aldosterone also, you know, at the level of the principal cell of the distal nephron, it actually increases the activity of the ENaC channel, okay? And if you increase the activity of that ENaC channel, more sodiums will be reabsorbed, right? If sodiums are reabsorbed, that will create negative charges on the urine side of the principal cell. That will drop potassium out of that principal cell, right? So that's why whenever a person has high levels of aldosterone at play, they will have a mild hypernatremia, right? But you have a hypokalemia as well, okay? And then another thing that aldosterone also does is it increases the activity of the proton pump that you find on the surface of the alpha intercalated cell, right? So if you increase the activity of that proton pump, you dump a lot of protons in the urine, right? That would ultimately cause a metabolic alkalosis. That's why, again, if a person has a hyperaldosterone state, they tend to get a metabolic alkalosis. They tend to become hypokalemic. I already described that. They tend to become hypernatremic, and they tend to become hypertensive, right? And you should understand the mechanism behind that hypertension as being a case of you're reabsorbing a ton of sodium, so water will follow alongside. So your blood volume expands, so your blood pressure expands. Now, what are some high yield things tested on step one that, again, if you've listened to any of my podcasts, you see that, oh, even if I title a podcast like renal pharmacology or whatever, right, I try to talk around and integrate multiple fields with that. So the thing is, if you're thinking about step one, right, remember that angiotensin, like in addition to converting angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2, angiotensin converting enzyme actually breaks down bradykinin, okay, to inactive metabolites. So the thing is, if you gave an ACE inhibitor, right, you will actually increase the levels of bradykinin, right? And by increasing levels of bradykinin, remember bradykinin is a very good bronchoconstrictor, right? So people can get like an airway, like reactive airway style response when they take an ACE inhibitor. And bradykinin also actually increases vascular permeability, right? So people can actually get edema with that. Right. So the thing is, the elevated bradykinin, it kind of explains the dry cough side effect that is classically seen with the ACE inhibitors. Okay. For the most part, you do not get this dry cough side effect when you're taking ARBs, an angiotensin receptor blocker. Now, with this said, you definitely want to make sure you remember this enzyme known as C1 esterase inhibitor. Okay. Many people make this like fatal mistake on NBMEs. Don't just say, oh, this person has a deficiency of C1 esterase. That's, at least for the purposes of the USMLEs, that's not the way I would want you to remember things. Think about things more in terms of a deficiency of C1 esterase inhibitor. The full enzyme name is not C1 esterase. It is C1 esterase inhibitor. It is very critical to make sure you understand this, because I've seen people host on the USMLEs by saying, oh, C1 esterase versus a C1 esterase inhibitor. So C1 esterase inhibitor, it's an enzyme. It's actually another enzyme that helps with breaking down bradykinin. So the thing is, it breaks down bradykinin. So if, for example, a person has a C1 esterase inhibitor deficiency, right? Then you want to try to avoid, because these people, right, think about it. So let's say you have like two major bradykinin breakdown pathways in the body. One pathway is ACE. The other pathway is C1 esterase inhibitor. And then a person, let's say, you know, they have some genetic snafu, and they have a C1 esterase inhibitor deficiency. You've taken out one of their major pathways for breaking down bradykinin. Well, if you give those people ACE inhibitors, all right, you've knocked out the second major pathway that they depend on. So they have effectively no real pathways for the breakdown of bradykinin. So when they have that, right, their levels of bradykinin will go up significantly, right? And they can get hereditary angioedema with that, right? Because again, I described some functions of bradykinin already. I said bradykinin increases vascular permeability, it causes bronchoconstriction and things like that. Now, what if you get a question on the USMLEs that says, how do concentrations of you know, like things. Let's say like angiotensin 1 and angiotensin 2. How do their concentrations change as you traverse, as you go from the pulmonary artery to the pulmonary vein? I would hope you're telling me that the angiotensin 1 concentrations actually decrease as you go from pulmonary artery to pulmonary vein, right? Because remember, it essentially encounters those endothelial cells in pulmonary capillaries that contain the angiotensin converting enzyme, right? But on the flip side, angiotensin 2 concentrations would increase, right? You may say, yeah, Divine, it's kind of like a benign mundane point. I promise you, it's a benign mundane point that is very high yield to know for the USMLEs. Now, the thing is, in fact, maybe think of this podcast as like a high yield surrounding renal pharmacology podcast. Because renal pharmacology is so high yield. But the thing is, your friends at the MBA may find multiple ways to tie it into like many other topics, right? So it's, again, kind of high yield to understand these things and understand them pretty well. So the thing is, remember that your arterioles are the blood vessels that directly feed capillaries. On the flip side, your venules are the blood vessels that directly drain capillaries. Now, the thing is, there are drugs like hydralazine. Hydralazine is a selective dilator of precapillary arterioles. Another drug class that works by selectively dilating precapillary arterioles are the dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers. Okay, so drugs like amlodipine, clavidipine, felodipine, stuff like that, right? So those drugs, they selectively dilate precapillary arterioles. So think about it. If you dilate the arterioles that feed capillaries, what happens to the hydrostatic pressures within those capillaries? I would hope you're telling me they increase, right? They should increase because you're sending more blood to them, because you're dilating the blood vessel that precedes those capillaries, right? So precapillary arterioles, if you dilate them by giving like a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, for example, the hydrostatic pressures in those capillaries will increase. And if hydrostatic pressures increase, if you're thinking about Starling forces, right, that will promote fluid extravasation into the interstitial space. So that will cause edema. That is why peripheral edema is a very common side effect in patients that are taking dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers. That is one thing your friends at the USMLE expect you to know. But there is more. The thing is, well, you have that problem, it sucks. How can I fix that? The thing is, if you wanted to fix the peripheral edema that arises as a side effect of taking a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, it should then make sense that you want to give something that can potentially decrease those hydrostatic pressures in the capillaries that are causing the edema, right? So think about it. What would you ideally want to do to the post-capillary venules if you wanted to fix the peripheral edema that is associated with taking a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker? Well, I would hope you're saying to dilate those post-capillary venules, right? Because if you dilate the post-capillary venules, you would have increased drainage from those capillaries. And if you drain those capillaries better, that would decrease the hydrostatic pressures. Well, guess what? It so happens there is a drug class that does that. And that's what I'm talking about it in renal pharmacology. Those are your ACE inhibitors. Your ACE inhibitors, they're actually very selective post-capillary venules. Okay, so they actually they are post-capillary venule dilators. So they are very good for treating the peripheral edema associated with taking a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker. Now, if a person has renal artery stenosis, right? I mean, they will classically describe like an old guy on MBME exams that has a flank brewery, has resistant hypertension, they've tried multiple drugs, his blood pressure doesn't seem to be coming down. I guess an analogous disease in the younger folk, especially the younger women, on MBMEs will be like fibromuscular dysplasia, okay? So those people tend to have like abdominal brewies, flank brewies, and all that stuff. That's why if you're doing the physical exam, right, when you're doing like an abdominal exam and they tell you, oh, I'm listening for abdominal brewies, you're effectively trying to listen for, especially if you listen on the flank, you're trying to listen for renal artery stenosis, that's old guy on MBME exams, or fibromuscular dysplasia, that is young female on MBME exams. And one thing that classically accompanies renal artery stenosis, so anything that causes like super bad hypertension, is AV nicking, arteriovenous nicking in the eye, okay? So nicking, N-I-C-K-I-N-G, so nick and then ing, okay? So AV nicking, that's a classic fundoscopic finding in people that have resistant hypertension or like malignant hypertension or people that have like renal artery stenosis, for example, because again, remember that renal artery stenosis can cause bad hypertension. And the thing is, hypertension vastly increases a person's risk for stroke, right? Hypertension is the biggest risk factor for stroke. Hypertension also causes like renal disease. I mean, like literally, hypertension and diabetes are probably the two, actually, they are not probably, they are the two most common causes of end-stage renal disease in the US. So now, what are the things that trigger release of renin, right? So let's again continue on our renal journey here. So some things that trigger the release of renin, right? If you hypoperfuse the afferent arterial, that will trigger renin release because the GG cells are like, oh crap, I'm not seeing enough blood volume. Well, I gotta spruce up blood volume by upping the activity of the renin-angiotensin aldosterone system. Another thing that can also trigger renin release is if you activate beta-1 receptors. So the thing is, classically, most med students think that, oh, beta-1 receptors, I find them only on the surfaces of cardiac myocytes. That could not be further from the truth. You find beta-1 receptors on the surface of cardiac myocytes, so they increase heart rate, increase contractility, so they are positive. By activating a beta-1 receptor, you have positive chronotropic, so increased heart rate, and positive inotropic, increased contractility effects. But in addition to that, you also increase the release of renin because they're actually beta-1 receptors at the level of the afferent arterial of the nephron. Okay, so that's very high yield to know. Now, if you also have low concentrations of like sodium or chloride that's detected by the macular densa, okay, by the macular densa, that will also trigger the release of renin. The thing is, the macular densa, they're a subunit of cells in the nephron, especially more so like the distal convoluted tubules. They're like chemical sensors. They sense like sodium and chloride concentrations. If they sense low sodium or low chloride, they secrete factors that tell the GG cells to secrete more renin. And the thing is, and again, I'm just saying this from the perspective of a person that has done a crap ton of renal research. Actually, I still do a ton of renal research, believe it or not. So I've probably looked up like more than 50,000 pathology images of the kidney. But essentially, the thing that happens here is, if you actually look on things on a histologic basis, the macular densa cells are actually closely tethered to the JG juxtaglomerular apparatus. If you look at them histologically, because many times, right, if you're trying to learn things like linearly, like, oh, the loop of Henle leads to the distal tubule and all that stuff, you may kind of lose sight of like some important things. But the thing is, geographically in the nephron, the macular densa cells of the distal convoluted tubule are almost like directly opposed to the other cells that make up the juxtaglomerular apparatus, right? Like the JG cells or the extraglomerular mesangial cells, for example, okay? So again, those are all high yield things, I guess maybe more for the purposes of understanding to keep in mind for exams. So I said again, low concentration of sodium and chloride sensed by the macular densa cells. That ultimately causes an increased release of renin. If you actually give a person like aspirin or like an NSAID, the release of renin actually increases because if you actually think about it, what does aspirin or most NSAIDs do? Right, they inhibit cyclooxygenase. Well, if you inhibited cyclooxygenase, right, what will happen to your levels of prostaglandin? It will go down. Well, if your prostaglandin levels go down, what happens to the afferent arterial? Does it constrict or does it dilate? It constricts. And if it constricts, that means your GG cells will start sensing low flow. And if they sense low flow, they will begin to secrete more renin. That is why if a person is on like NSAIDs or aspirin for like prolonged periods of time, that can actually cause like a reactive hypertension in a sense. Okay. And I mean, remember, right, aldosterone, and this is something that you like daily learn in like an endocrinology block. In fact, I'll say probably some of the stuff I'll mention from now, although actually maybe the next 5 minutes, I'll mention a lot more renal stuff. But the thing is, your friends at the MBME love to integrate renal with endocrine. So I'm going to talk about some endocrinology in the context of renal. If you've not had an endocrinology block yet, you should still be able to understand what I describe because I'm going to try to describe everything in fairly good detail. So the thing is, remember aldosterone, right? It's a steroid hormone, right? So its receptors will not be found on the surface of a cell. Its receptors will be found inside a cell. Okay, and the thing is, when aldosterone, right, because it's a steroid hormone, it should be able to cross cell membranes without issue. It gets into the cell, it binds to the aldosterone receptor. Okay, that receptor and aldosterone then goes to response elements on DNA. Okay, so that you can increase the synthesis of the stuff that you want. So let's do some arrow pushing here. I know some people have studied hyperventilating. Oh no, Divine wants to start talking organic chemistry. No. Arrow pushing in the context of the MBMEs are when you get questions where they give you like four or five different things, and then they put all these arrows flying all over the place, like some arrows going up, some arrows going down, and all that crap. So I want to do a bunch of those questions probably for the next 10 to 15 minutes. And because this stuff is kind of technical, after I do this, I think I'll go ahead and pause this podcast and pick up in the next one on renal pharmacology. So, and the next podcast, fair warning, I'm going to describe all the transporters in the nephron in great detail. And you may say, do I need to know those transporters in great detail for the USMLE exams? Yes, you do. Okay, more so for the USMLE Step 1 exam, but also, believe it or not, for the USMLE Step 2 CK exam and the Step 3 exam, these transporters show up all the time. Okay, I promise you, as a person that has taken all the USMLE exams that currently exist, knowing those transporters is just one of those things that will set you up very well, both for your future taking MBME USMLE exams, and also for your future taking maybe, I guess, med school exams, and also for your future practicing as a clinician, believe it or not. So the thing is, let's assume a patient takes an ACE inhibitor. What happens to their levels of renin? It should go up, right? Because think about it. What does an ACE... The thing is, whenever you get these arrow questions, the first thing you should ask yourself is, okay, what's happening when I introduce this intervention? If you give an ACE inhibitor, you're inhibiting angiotensin-converting enzyme. So you're essentially inhibiting the conversion of angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2. So if you're preventing the conversion of angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2, well, guess what? Your levels of angiotensin 1 should increase, and your levels of angiotensin 2 should decrease. And if your levels of angiotensin 2 decrease, then you will have less stimulation of aldosterone release from the zona glomerulosa of the adrenal cortex. So your aldosterone levels go down. And if your aldosterone levels go down, that means you'll stop reabsorbing sodium in the nephron. And water, you essentially, by not reabsorbing sodium, you'll also not be reabsorbing as much water. So your blood volume will decrease. Your blood pressure will decrease. And if your blood pressure decreases, you'll have less perfusion of your afferent arterial. So what would that do to the release of renin? That will actually increase renin release. Okay, so that is why if a patient is on an ACE inhibitor, their levels of renin and angiotensin 1 both go up, but their levels of angiotensin 2 and aldosterone both go down. Now, what if a patient is placed on an angiotensin receptor blocker, right? If a person is placed on an angiotensin receptor blocker, what should happen to their levels of renin? It should go up, right? Because again, by giving an angiotensin receptor blocker, right, you will block every activity of angiotensin 2. And by blocking every activity of angiotensin 2, well, guess what? You will essentially, again, block those angiotensin 2 receptors that you find in the zona glomerulosa of the adrenal cortex. So you'll stop releasing aldosterone. So your aldosterone levels will fall. If your aldosterone levels fall, you will stop reabsorbing sodium and water in the nephron. So your blood pressure will go down. Your blood volume will go down. So your blood pressure goes down. If your blood pressure goes down, you would hypoperfuse the afferent arterial. If you hypoperfuse the afferent arterial, you will increase your release of renin because you rev up that, you make those GG cells a little more antsy. Okay. So you make more renin, you make more angiotensin 1, you make more angiotensin 2. But your aldosterone will remain persistently low because those angiotensin 2 receptors have been blocked. So you would not be able to observe angiotensin 2 style effects. So do you see the subtle differences in these arrows if you're comparing taking an ACE inhibitor to an angiotensin receptor blocker, right? Because in an ACE inhibitor, if you take that, your renin and your angiotensin 1 levels go up, but your angiotensin 2 and aldosterone levels go down. If you take an angiotensin receptor blocker, your renin, angiotensin 1, and angiotensin 2 levels all go up, but your aldosterone levels actually stay down. Now, what if you took this drug known as aliskiren, right? So A-L-I-S-K-I-R-E-N, aliskiren, right? Aliskiren is a direct inhibitor of renin, right? So what actually happens to your renin levels if you take aliskiren?
it actually goes down, right? So your renin will go down. Well, if your renin goes down, remember, renin is the feedstock for the renin-angiotensin aldosterone system. If your renin goes down, well, guess what? Your angiotensin 1 will go down. If your angiotensin 1 goes down, angiotensin 2 will go down. If angiotensin 2 goes down, your aldosterone will go down. So everything is low when a person is on aliskiri. But what if a person took spironolactone? Spironolactone is an aldosterone receptor antagonist. Spironolactone is an aldosterone receptor antagonist. Well, if you took an aldosterone receptor antagonist, right, you will not observe the functions of aldosterone, right? So that improves the activity of the sodium chloride transporter, SIMPOTER, that you find that the level of the distal convoluted tubule, or that activity of helping the ENaC channel at the principal cell work even better, or those proton pumps, right, at the alpha intercalated cell working better, all those would not happen, right? So the thing is, if those things do not happen, right, you're not reabsorbing sodium and chloride in the nephron, so water is not flowing alongside, so your blood volume goes down, your blood pressure goes down, you hypoperfuse the afferent arterial, so your renin will go up, your angiotensin 1 will go up, your angiotensin 2 will go up, your aldosterone will also go up, because the aldosterone, you're not getting its effect, so that negative feedback just is not there, so everything will be up. Okay, so the thing is, again, make sure it's like super, super important that you understand these scenarios I just described. These things have shown up countless times on the USMLE exams. Now, another thing you want to keep at the back of your mind is you can also see how they can stretch these questions to begin to talk about things like sodium, potassium, acid base, like, oh, what happens to the blood pH? What happens to the blood hydrogen ion concentration, stuff like that. So let me give you an example with spironolactone, right? If a person takes spironolactone, right, which is an aldosterone receptor blocker, right, you're not getting the aldosterone effects, right? So instead of becoming hypernatremic, you'll be hyponatremic because you're failing to reabsorb sodium at the level of the distal convoluted tubule and also at the level of the principal cell of the collecting duct. Those people will also get hyperkalemia. Okay, hyperkalemia, because again, if you're not reabsorbing sodium at the level of the principal cell of the collecting duct, you do not create those negative charges on the urine side that serve to draw potassium out of the principal cell. Okay, so you actually become hyperkalemic, right? And then think about it. If those alpha intercalated cells are not working, at least those proton pumps on the urine side of the alpha intercalated cells are not working, then you're not dumping protons into the urine. And if you're not, that means you're retaining those protons. So you get a metabolic acidosis, right? So the blood pH should fall in a patient that is taking spironolactone. The same things you would also observe in a patient that's taking eplerenone. Eplerenone is another aldosterone receptor antagonist. The only benefit eplerenone has over spironolactone is that eplerenone just blocks aldosterone receptors. But spironolactone, in addition to blocking aldosterone receptors, it also blocks androgen receptors, so it can cause gynecomastia as a side effect. Now, what if they tell you a patient has like renal artery stenosis or fibromuscular dysplasia? Let's sort of keep this train of renin, angiotensin 1, angiotensin 2, blah, 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 blah going. So if a person has renal artery stenosis or fibromuscular dysplasia, obviously, those people will stop perfusing the afferent arterial, right? So again, the renin will go up, angiotensin 1 will go up, angiotensin 2 will go up, aldosterone will go up, right? Now, what if a person has Addison's disease? What if a person has Addison's disease? Remember, Addison's disease is a primary adrenal insufficiency, okay? So it's like an autoimmune destruction of the adrenal glands. So the adrenals get all screwed up, especially more so the adrenal cortex. So if you destroy the adrenal cortex, right? Well, you will no longer be able to make cortisol, you will no longer be able to make aldosterone, you will no longer be able to mix at least DHEAS, the sex steroid or DHEAS, right? So if that happens, well, think about if you're not making aldosterone, right, and you're not making cortisol. Remember, cortisol actually has a permissive effect on the sympathetic nervous system. You may say, Divine, how? There are many ways, but one big one they expect you to know on the USMLE exams is there's this enzyme that converts norepinephrine to epinephrine. It's known as PNMT, phenyl, I think ethanolamine N-methyltransferase or something like that. That enzyme So that enzyme, right, it converts norepinephrine to epinephrine, right? And I mean, essentially, right, phenylethanolamine N-methyl transferase, right? So it uses, it essentially adds a methyl group to norepinephrine to make epinephrine. So it should maybe help you remember that SAM, S-adenosylmethionine, is a cofactor for that enzyme. Believe it or not, that's something floridly high yield to know for the USMLEs. SAM is a cofactor for a PNMT. Okay, remember, methionine is a very good methyl group carrier in the body. So, so if a person has Addison's disease, they're not making aldosterone, right? They're not making cortisol. So obviously your blood pressure, your blood volume is going to fall. I mean, your blood pressure is going to fall, right? Because you're not getting that help me reabsorb sodium chloride in the nephron kind of business going anymore. Okay, and again, that permissive effect of a cortisol on the sympathetic nervous system where it activates PNMT in the adrenal medulla, right, to help you convert like norepinephrine to epinephrine is no longer there. So your blood pressure falls. If your blood pressure falls, that will spruce up the activity of the renin-angiotensin aldosterone system, right, because you'll be hypoperfusing the afferent arterial. So your renin will go up, your angiotensin 1 will go up, your angiotensin 2 will go up, but your aldosterone would not go up because even if there is angiotensin 2 around, your adrenal cortex is all screwed up. So like the site of production of aldosterone is literally gone. So your aldosterone levels will fall. One thing I will go ahead and say is you should be able to contrast primary adrenal insufficiency with secondary adrenal insufficiency with reference to aldosterone levels, right? So whenever you have a primary problem in endocrinology, it means it's at the level of the organ itself, the gland itself, right? So like the adrenal gland is screwed up in primary adrenal insufficiency, right? But the thing is, if you have a problem one level higher, let's say at the level of the anterior pituitary gland, that'll be a secondary adrenal insufficiency, right? The thing is, when people have secondary adrenal insufficiency, their cortisol levels will be low. Because basically, secondary adrenal insufficiency means you have an ACTH deficiency. So their cortisol levels will be low. Their sex steroid levels, like DHEAS primarily, will be low as well. But the thing is, their aldosterone levels will be just fine. Remember, very early in this podcast, I said that the zona glomerulosa is not under the control of ACTH. So if you have an ACTH problem, your zona glomerulosa works just okay. Okay, so you'll have normal levels of aldosterone in secondary adrenal insufficiency, where you have decreased levels of cortisol and your sex steroids that are supposed to come from the adrenal gland. Again, more commonly, DHEAS. And you should also at least hopefully remember, right, that if a person has adrenal insufficiency of any kind, especially like primary adrenal insufficiency, aka Addison's disease, their eosinophil levels go up. Okay, the eosinophil levels go up. That's something you'd want to know, like, for your future in medicine, essentially. It shows up on all the USMLE exams, shows up on the medicine shelf exam, shows up on a ton of stuff, right? So, because remember, cortisol actually causes apoptosis of eosinophils, right? So, if your cortisol levels are down because your adrenal glands have been destroyed, well, you have decreased apoptosis of eosinophils, so your eosinophil count should go up. You should also remember, right, that if a person has adrenal insufficiency, their white blood cell count should ideally go down because there is decreased demargination of neutrophils, right? Again, those are all things you kind of want to make sure you know for MBME exams. Now, what if a person has the disease Kahn syndrome? If a person has Kahn syndrome, what should happen to their levels of renin, angiotensin 1, angiotensin 2, and aldosterone? Well, think about it. Kahn syndrome is a disorder. Again, I told you, whenever you see these arrow questions, always define the problem that is being tested. When you don't define the problem and just say, oh, I'm just going to start from anywhere, I can almost assure you very likely, it's only if like your command of physiology is very good, which unfortunately is not the case for many medical students. If I define the problem first and then go from that point, before you then begin to build other parts of the arrow pushing question. So if a person has Kahn syndrome, in Kahn syndrome, you have an adenoma in the adrenal gland, more likely in the adrenal cortex, that's making a ton of aldosterone, right? So obviously, if you're making a ton of aldosterone, right, you know, again, you will increase the activity of that sodium chloride SIMP order. You may say, Divine, you've repeated this thing multiple times. Repetition always helps, especially in renal. I'm going to do a lot of repetition. I guess let me call it targeted repetition because I'm repeating the same thing but in different contexts. I will do the same thing in the next renal farm podcast, because those transporters are bare to learn for many people. But the thing is, once you learn them well the first time and see how they apply pharmacology wise, which is what I'm going to do, right? I'm not just going to give you random names of transporters to memorize. No, I'm going to talk about the transporters, and then I'm going to talk about them in the context of renal pharmacology. And if you learn those things well, you should really not forget them. That's the truth. So Kahn syndrome, adrenal adenoma, secreting a creptin of aldosterone, right? So you'll increase the activity of that sodium chloride symporter. Now you find that the level of the distal convoluted tubule, right? And you'll also increase the activity of the ENaC channel, that again, you'll find that the level of the principal cell of the distal nephron. So those things will increase your blood sodium. Water will follow alongside. So your blood volume increases, your blood pressure increases, right? So you would hyperperfuse the afferent arterial. If you hyperperfuse the afferent arterial, that will dial down the renin-angiotensin system, right? So those people's levels of renin will go down, okay? Their levels of angiotensin 1 will go down. Their levels of angiotensin 2 will also go down as well, okay? That is why you actually use the plasma aldosterone to renin ratio. So the plasma aldosterone to renin ratio to screen. Let me not say diagnose, because to diagnose Kahn syndrome, you do like some salt suppression crap, but that's more for endocrinology. So in a person that has Kahn syndrome, right? So you measure the plasma aldosterone to renin ratio will be elevated, because the aldosterone is going up because the adenoma is secreting aldosterone, but the renin is coming down. Okay. I would hope you're able to contrast this with renal artery stenosis, where the aldosterone and renin are both going up, right? So the aldosterone to renin ratio will be normal, right? It should be like less than 20 or thereabouts. Different resources use different numbers, versus Kahn syndrome that has an elevated plasma aldosterone to renin ratio. Now, what if a person has one of the congenital adrenal hyperplasias and they have it from an 11 beta? So this is, again, a very nice way your friends at the MBME love to integrate endocrine with renal. What if a person has an 11 beta hydroxylase deficiency? For those of you that have not reviewed endocrinology, let me talk through this real quick. Basically, if a person has an 11 beta hydroxylase deficiency, they will not be able to make aldosterone, and they will not be able to make cortisol. Okay, it's an endocrine disorder. I think I've either talked about this more fully in an endocrine podcast I've made in the past, or I will talk about it more fully when I make an endocrine-related podcast. But basically, the thing that happens is that if people have an 11-beta hydroxylase deficiency, they will not be able to make aldosterone or cortisol, right? But the thing is, 11-beta hydroxylase, if you have that deficiency, you have a buildup of a compound known as 11-deoxycorticosterone, okay? I'll say that again, 11-deoxycorticosterone. Corticosterone, so 11, a hyphen, and then deoxycorticosterone, 11-deoxycorticosterone. The thing is, 11-deoxycorticosterone is a special compound that has partial agonist activity at mineralocorticoid receptors. I'll say that again. 11-deoxycorticosterone is a compound that has partial agonist activity on mineralocorticoid receptors. So the thing is, you will get a partial aldosterone effect when a person has an 11 beta hydroxylase deficiency. So the thing that happens is, if you have that 11 beta hydroxylase deficiency, again, just by virtue of, because that enzyme comes upstream of the production of aldosterone and cortisol, your aldosterone levels will be low. Okay, your aldosterone levels will be low, but look at why your friends at the MBME will be like having this sheepish grin when they're writing this kind of question. Your levels of aldosterone will be low. So you'll think, that means because there's no negative feedback, renin will be high, angiotensin 1 and 2 will be high. That could not be further from the truth. Okay, so you got to be careful there on the USMLEs. The thing is, by virtue of the enzyme defect, your aldosterone levels are low, granted. But one of the things that builds up because you have that block in that pathway is, again, this magic compound I talk about, 11-deoxycorticosterone. And because 11-deoxycorticosterone has partial agonist activity on mineralocorticoid receptors, you do get an aldosterone-like effect. So you actually increase the reabsorption of sodium and chloride at the level of the nephron. So that will actually raise your blood volume, raise your blood pressure. So you will actually hyperperfuse the afferent arteriole. So people that have 11 beta hydroxylase deficiency will have low levels of renin, low levels of angiotensin 1, and low levels of angiotensin 2. And again, by virtue of the enzyme defects, they will also have low levels of aldosterone. Okay, again, I really hope you understand this. This is floridly high, you ought to know, for the USMLE Step 1 exam. And then, what if a person has a 21 hydroxylase deficiency? That's another adrenal cortical enzyme defect. In fact, this is actually the most common cause, very high yield. This is the most common cause of congenital adrenal hyperplasia. Okay, and I guess before I talk about the 21 hydroxylase deficiency, some people may say, Divine, what's this crap called congenital adrenal hyperplasia? Well, think about it. In general, with these conditions, you have trouble making aldosterone or cortisol. Well, guess what? If you're not making aldosterone or cortisol, well, if you're not, at least more so the cortisol, right? By not making cortisol, you have no negative feedback at the level of the anterior pituitary, right? So your ACTH levels go up. And I mean, literally, ACTH stands for adrenocorticotropic hormone. It's a hormone that is tropic to the adrenal cortex. So because the levels of ACTH go up significantly with these congenital adrenal hyperplasias, the thing that happens is you're going to very widely stimulate the adrenal cortex. So the adrenal cortex expands significantly in patients with any of these disorders. And these patients also tend to get, you know, pretty significant skin hyperpigmentation, because ACTH, as it so happens, comes from a compound known as POMC. POMC, like POMC, pro-opio-melanocortin. Pro-opio-melanocortin. The name literally tells you the things that come from the compound. Pro-opio, opio, and opioid comes from POMC. That opioid is beta endorphin. And again, I'm saying all these not because I like to hear myself speak. I'm saying all these because these things show up a ton on the USMLE exams, right? So pro-opio-melanocortin, right? So POMC gives rise to an opioid, beta endorphin. Beta endorphin acts on mu opioid receptors. So melanocyte stimulating hormone comes from POMC as well. It stimulates melanocytes, right? So that's why you have skin hyperpigmentation in a person that has a congenital adrenal hyperplasia or even adrenal insufficiency of any cause, right? Let me not say of any cause, more specifically like a primary adrenal insufficiency, because anything that essentially will raise your ACTH levels will cause skin hyperpigmentation. And then, so pro-opio-melanocortin. So the cortin stands for the ACTH, okay? So again, I really hope you understand these things. Again, you may say, Divine, you're going into a lot of detail, but I promise you, I have taught and tutored thousands of people that take these exams. These things show up a ton on MBME USMLE exams. Okay, so back to what we're talking about, and then we'll round this up, right? So if a person has a 21 hydroxylase deficiency, again, like I said, this is the most common cause of congenital adrenal hyperplasia. These people will have no aldosterone, right? They will have no cortisol. But actually, in 21 hydroxylase deficiency, your 11-deoxycorticosterone does not build up. This enzyme is more upstream of 11-deoxycorticosterone. So you don't have that magic compound that has like partial agonist activity on mineralocorticoid receptors. So guess what? By virtue of the enzyme deficiency, you don't make aldosterone. So that's a given. Your aldosterone levels are going to be low, right? But because you are not making aldosterone, you're not making cortisol, or you're not making the magic compound 11-deoxycorticosterone that has partial agonist activity on mineralocorticoid receptors, well, you're not reabsorbing sodium chloride at the level of the distal convoluted tubule. You're not reabsorbing sodium through that inner channel at the principal cell of the collecting duct. So your blood sodium goes down. So your blood volume goes down. So your blood pressure goes down, right? So if your blood pressure goes down, well, guess what? You will hypoperfuse the afferent arteriole. If you hypoperfuse the afferent arteriole, well, your renin levels will go up, because the GG cells will start freaking out. Your renin levels will go up, angiotensin 1 levels will go up, and your angiotensin 2 levels will go up as well. Okay? So again, these are all higher things to know. So can you see that two enzyme deficiencies within the same gland, 11 beta hydroxylase deficiency versus 21 hydroxylase deficiency, which is more common, right, can cause widely varying effects on like renin, angiotensin 1, angiotensin 2, and aldosterone levels, right? So again, that's why your friends at the MBME love to test this stuff. So I'm going to go ahead and pause here. As I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE exams, step one, 2CK, 2CS, step three. Okay. I do also offer one-on-one tutoring for like med school preclinical exams and the third year clerkship shelf exams. Okay. And then I also do this thing that I've talked about ad nauseum over the last couple of podcasts that I call longitudinal tutoring, where I essentially tutor you through, let's say you're newly minted first year or second year, I tutor you through all your class exams. And then I tutor you during your dedicated period. But the thing is, as I tutor you through all those class exams, I also tutor you for step one at the same time. So you're essentially reviewing step one material as you're going through your class material with a person that is very well versed in that material, in that content, I guess. Same thing with the third year med student. If you're studying out your third year, I tutor you for all your shelf exams. At the same time, I'm also tutoring you for step 2CK, like teaching you test taking strategies and all that stuff, and teaching you content as well. So that again, when you hit your dedicated period, you're like super well prepared. Like everyone I've done this with has been like wildly successful on their USMLE exams. And then if you have like a college buddy that needs tutoring for Gen Chem, OChem, physics, biochem, histology, and physiology, I offer tutoring for all those things. And then if you're a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCAS application, or a med student applying to residency, so an ERAS application, I do one-on-one like consulting or advising for those. I've worked with tons of people through many cycle admission cycles, and the vast majority of those people have matched at their first choices, right? So things like personal statement help, letter of recommendation help, mock interview help, editing and reviewing your ERAS application. Those are things I all do. So if you know anyone that needs all those, either reach out to me through the website or send me an email at divineinterventionpodcasts with an S at the end at gmail.com. So I do hope you got something from this podcast. I'll pick up from here in the next one. Have a wonderful rest of your day. God bless you. I'll see you next time. Thank you.